You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to episode number 131 of our Civil War podcast. I'm Rich.
And I'm Tracy. Hello y'all, welcome to the podcast. We know that with the last show, we actually just got McClellan's Peninsula campaign launched. But before we get back to the action, we decided that we wanted to hit the pause button this week and use this episode to talk about a couple of things that we've already alluded to previously, but that we think are worth taking the time to stress, since they're vital to understanding what happens on the peninsula.
We want to use this episode to cover three topics. One, McClellan's relationship with the Army of the Potomac, which really was a kind of a cult of personality. Two, McClellan's suspicious arithmetic and the security of Washington. And related to that, then three, Lincoln and Stanton's decision to withhold McDowell's corps from McClellan and instead keep that force in Northern Virginia in the vicinity of Washington.
In the episodes we devoted to the background to the Peninsula campaign, one of the things we tried to stress again and again was the extraordinary bond that developed between George McClellan and the soldiers of the Army of the Potomac. Ethan Rafuse, in his book McClellan's War, talks about this strong and personal connection that the general consciously fostered between himself and his army. Rafuse writes, quote, McClellan recognized the American citizen soldier was sensitive to his rights and would not tolerate the brutish discipline to which soldiers serving authoritarian regimes in Europe were subjected. Moreover, an authoritarian approach to leadership was repugnant to a man of McClellan's taste and background.
Rafuse continues, saying, quote, more attractive to McClellan was the paternal style of leadership. Paternalism emphasized that the relationship between ruler and ruled must be based on mutual respect, affection, and the evident moral and intellectual superiority of the leader. The paternal leader did not instill discipline and secure obedience from his followers through fear and coercion. Instead, he appealed to the reason and consciences of his followers.
Rafuse concludes by noting that, quote, historian Daniel Walker Howe writes that the paternalistic leader provided a father figure in whom devotees could feel a measure of security and offered followers an exemplar of ideals, in short, a hero. The follower took security in the conviction that his interests were in the hands of a man of superior intellect and character. This paternalism permeated McClellan's efforts to build the Army of the Potomac. His powerful intellect, tremendous capacity for work, and consciously cultivated heroic image inspired respect, and he built upon this by his efforts to make himself known to the men personally. His constant presence, encouraging, praising, and offering paternal guidance as they were transformed from an armed mob into an army, captured the hearts of his men. This army would depart from its camps in 1862, the embodiment of his values, an efficient, disciplined force guided by a paternalistic, professional hand. End quote.
In the last show, we mentioned the proclamation that McClellan issued to the Army of the Potomac on March 17th as the first units began boarding ships at Alexandria bound for Fort Monroe. Little Mac informed his men that, quote, "For a long time I have kept you inactive, but not without purpose. You were to be disciplined, armed, and instructed," end quote. Now that that task was complete, he proclaimed that, quote, "The Army of the Potomac is now a real army, magnificent in material, admirable in discipline and instruction, excellently equipped and armed. I know I can trust you to save the country."
McClellan cautioned his men that a difficult test lay ahead, but assured them they would meet the challenges that faced them together. He added, quote, "My fate is linked with yours, and all that I do is to bring you where I know you wish to be, on the decisive battlefield. I am to watch over you as a parent over his children. It shall be my care, as it has ever been, to gain success with the least possible loss. But I know that if it is necessary, you will willingly follow me to our graves for our righteous cause." End quote.
As we said before, George McClellan believed that the fate of the Republic rested in his hands and absolutely depended on the triumph of the moderate, conciliatory principles and policies he represented. And his fate, in turn, depended on the success of his Army of the Potomac. This became even truer after Lincoln relieved Little Mac as General-in-Chief on March 11th, on the grounds that McClellan had taken the field in Northern Virginia as the major general in command of the Army of the Potomac, and that was responsibility enough. After that, since the Army of the Potomac was all that was left to him, McClellan became even more convinced that his army must not be exposed to the risk of a serious defeat, since a reverse in the field would be doubly fatal. It would embolden the South to continue the war, and by discrediting McClellan, it would provide his political enemies in Washington with an excuse to remove him from command of his Army of the Potomac.
The point we really want to make is that while McClellan deserves credit for building the Army of the Potomac into a powerful instrument of war, there should also be no mistaking the fact that the army Little Mac created was also a political instrument. McClellan tried to maintain direct control over every part of his vast army from his own headquarters, which was manned by staff officers chosen for their loyalty to Little Mac, as well as for their expertise. McClellan's headquarters was a closed circle, an echo chamber that amplified the commanding general's attitudes and opinions. In the army at large, McClellan favored his loyalist and ignored or neglected his critics, which divided the Army of the Potomac's officer corps into pro- and anti-McClellan camps.
Regarding the rank-and-file soldiers of his army, McClellan obviously worked to bind the ordinary soldiers to him by a strong and personal bond, and on some level, he seemed to need their approval, their adulation. Convinced as Little Mac was that he faced enemies to the rear in Washington, the cheers of his men, their hero worship, was a balm to him. His letters to his wife are filled with anecdotes of soldiers, singly and in masses, cheering him, praising him as the savior of the nation. Yet, as we'll see during the Peninsula Campaign, the love McClellan so often professed for his men is sentimental rather than authentic. He rarely visited the wounded in the field hospitals or shared the risks of the battle line with them. Historian Richard Slotkin notes that what McClellan, quote, "loves about his men is their love for him, the way they idolize him. In a world of enemies, the Army of the Potomac was McClellan's hearth and refuge, created by himself, an extension of his identity. His love for it was self-love, but no less real and powerful for that. As an extension or projection of McClellan's identity, the Army of the Potomac could not risk taking the field until it had been made indestructible."
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Now let's turn to the second item of the agenda, McClellan's suspicious arithmetic and the security of Washington. As y'all recall, Abraham Lincoln had agreed to McClellan's plan for the Peninsula Campaign, although the president still had reservations about it. One of Lincoln's foremost concerns was for the security of Washington once the Army of the Potomac was taken off to the peninsula. The president had insisted that McClellan seek the opinions of his corps commanders on the subject of how many troops were needed to protect the capital. But the corps commanders differed in their answers, with the minimum figure being 40,000 and the maximum being over 50,000.
McClellan has to be held to blame for failing to comprehend Lincoln and Secretary of War Edwin Stanton's deep concern for the safety of the Capitol. In the run-up to the Peninsula Campaign, McClellan made no effort to meet with them to discuss the issue and explain his ideas. Instead, he waited until he was aboard ship on April 1st and ready to depart for the peninsula before he furnished Lincoln with any accounting of the forces left to defend Washington. At that point, McClellan finally dispatched a letter that used some misrepresentative mathematics to list more than 73,000 men he felt were dedicated to complying with his corps commander's recommendations with regard to Lincoln's instructions to ensure the security of the Capitol. The 73,000 men McClellan counted as providing for the protection of Washington consisted of 10,859 at Manassas, 7,780 at Warrenton, some 18 miles west of Manassas, 35,467 out in the Shenandoah Valley, 1,350 on the lower Potomac below Washington, and 22,000 in and around the Capitol.
It would make your head spin if we got into the nitty-gritty of McClellan's suspicious arithmetic with regard to those numbers, so you'll just have to trust us when we say that at Manassas, Little Mac was counting men who were not really there, and in Washington, he was counting men he had only recommended be sent there. The numbers game continued with the 7,780 at Warrenton, which McClellan counted twice, once as part of the Shenandoah Valley Force and again as part of the Manassas total. As T. Harry Williams concludes, McClellan was playing, quote, fast and loose and careless with all his figures, end quote.
In reality, McClellan left about 50,000 men that could be called on to defend Washington and its approaches. And while this number is consistent with the upper figure recommended by his corps commanders, only 29,000 of these were actually either in and around Washington or at Manassas or Warrenton. And Abraham Lincoln certainly assumed that the figure arrived at by the corps commanders referred to troops actually in the Washington forts and encampments, not as far away as the Shenandoah Valley. McClellan's great failure in this regard, besides playing fast and loose with the numbers, was that he never took the time to explain to Lincoln that a location, such as Washington, could be protected by defending the spot itself, or by denying the enemy the approaches to the city, or by threatening the enemy elsewhere to prevent them from attacking the capital. Understood in these terms, even McClellan's Peninsula Campaign could be explained in the context of defending Washington. But as we said, McClellan never took the time to explain any of this to Lincoln. and Little Mac's inexcusable failure to address the president's concern for Washington would come back to haunt the general as his operation on the peninsula progressed.
The third topic on today's agenda is closely related to the last one, in that it was the discovery of McClellan's suspicious arithmetic that led Lincoln and Stanton to withhold McDowell's corps from Little Mac. As we explained last week, it was on April 5th, the same day his forces on the peninsula came up against the Confederates' unexpected Warwick River defensive line, that McClellan received the telegram from Washington announcing that McDowell's First Corps was being detached from his command. Lincoln, it was subsequently explained, considered the forces that McClellan had left for the defense of the capital, quote, insufficient to ensure its safety, end quote.
What had happened was that the commander of the Washington defenses, Brigadier General James Wadsworth, had told Lincoln that his immediate force on hand for the capital's protection numbered only 19,000 men, and he said that that force, quote, was new and imperfectly disciplined, in my judgment, entirely inadequate and unfit for the important duty to which it is assigned, end quote. When Lincoln and Stanton checked into Wadsworth's claim and found that McClellan's numbers were more than a bit sketchy, they decided to hold back McDowell's corps for the protection of Washington. The First Corps, led by McDowell, just happened to be the one part of the Army of the Potomac that hadn't yet embarked for the peninsula, so that's why it was the formation the president ordered be left behind to guard the capital.
In a letter that night to his wife, an enraged McClellan called the president's decision, quote, the most infamous thing that history has recorded, end quote. Now more convinced than ever that his political enemies in Washington were conspiring against him and intent upon his ruin, McClellan telegraphed Lincoln that the loss of the First Corps imperiled his entire campaign. A year later, when he came to write his official report on the Peninsula campaign, Little Mac was still furious. He labeled the withholding of McDowell's corps a, quote, fatal error, making it impossible for him to execute the, quote, rapid and brilliant operations he had so carefully planned. He declared that, quote, I know of no instance in military history where a general in the field had received such a discouraging blow.
As McClellan viewed it, the real reason for holding back the First Corps was to cripple his attempt to take Richmond. If he were thwarted in his plans to capture the enemy capital and end the rebellion, then the war would continue, and the radicals in Washington would have a better chance to turn the Civil War into a revolution with emancipation and the upending of Southern society as its goal. As McClellan told his friend Barlow in New York, the sabotaging of his campaign was all a conspiracy originating in, quote, the stupidity and wickedness of his enemies in the government.
There was no substance whatsoever to McClellan's conspiracy theory, and as we've said, the real blame for the entire episode lies with McClellan himself and his failure to adequately address Lincoln's fears for the protection of Washington. But having said that, there's no doubt of Little Mac's sincere belief in a conspiracy to undermine his plans. He was unable to recognize failings in himself, so he needed to blame others for whatever went wrong with his grand campaign.
There was also no substance to McClellan's claim that holding back McDowell to guard Washington derailed his plans for getting the Peninsula campaign off to a running start. Instead, it was Little Mac's own decision to bring the advance to a dead stop in front of Yorktown for an entire month. The First Corps had not even been a high priority in his planning for that initial stage of the march up the peninsula. By his own scheduling, it was to be 2 weeks still, or more, before McDowell's divisions began to reach Fort Monroe. According to Stephen Sears in his book, To the Gates of Richmond, quote, General McClellan's declarations to the contrary, the president's decision to hold back McDowell did not dictate the decision to besiege Yorktown. It did not affect the way the siege was conducted, or even how long it lasted. The sole author of the siege of Yorktown was George Britton McClellan. End quote.
So really, it was the 29-day-long campaign-delaying siege of Yorktown itself that was the fatal error, not the withholding of McDowell's corps. Abraham Lincoln certainly believed this to be the case, telling Secretary of the Navy Gideon Welles, quote, "There was no reason why he should have been detained a single day in front of Yorktown," end quote.
In the opening phase of the Peninsula Campaign, 60,000 to 70,000 Union troops, with another 30,000 on the way, faced no more than 15,000 Confederates defending the Yorktown and Warwick River defensive line. Joe Johnston's main force of 45,000 or so rebel soldiers wouldn't fully arrive on the scene for 3 weeks. Had McClellan struck hard and marched on Richmond with the entire force he had on hand at the start of the campaign, he would most likely have found the enemy capital defended by fewer than 60,000 Confederates, who would have been off balance after their hasty withdrawal from their position north of Richmond to face this new, unforeseen threat. But instead, Little Mac threw away the advantage he had gained by moving his army to the peninsula. At the first instance of being confronted by the unexpected, his strategic boldness turned to tactical timidity, and he spent 1 month besieging Yorktown, and as we'll see, will spend another month working his way up the peninsula. By the time he reaches the outskirts of Richmond in early June, Joe Johnston's whole force and substantial reinforcements will be waiting to oppose him.
That means it's time for this episode's book recommendation. And our recommendation this time is Forward to Richmond, McClellan's Peninsula Campaign by Ronald H. Bailey and the editors of Time Life Books.
Our recent recommendation of that Echoes of Glory Civil War Atlas sparked a discussion here among your hosts about why we had never, in about 130 episodes, why we had never before recommended one of the books in this venerable old Time Life series on the Civil War. And you know the series we mean, right? The silver covers, the U.S. and C.S. badges on the front, all the great illustrations, and of course, maps. Well, anyway, we decided it was high time we make one of them an official book recommendation. So here it is, Forward to Richmond.
Don't forget, you can find all of our book recommendations at the podcast website, which is www.civilwarpodcast.org.
Just yesterday, we released the second members episode on Island Number 10, and next up in November will be the Fall of New Orleans. And we have a couple of new members of the Strawfoot Brigade to thank, David and Daniel. Thanks, guys. And then also a big thanks, as always, to Spiritwood Music for their permission to use their song Midnight on the Water as the music you hear at the beginning and end of each episode of the podcast.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Civil War, 1861 to 1865, a history podcast. Rich and I hope you'll join us again next time when we get back to the action with McClellan's Peninsula Campaign. But until then, take care.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.